G'day, mates. You're listening to Jewels and Bullets, the You and My Discography podcast, a show where a You and My fan and a You and My super fan discuss each of the band's records. I'm Tommy Waite, an Aussie writer and podcaster who's based out of Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm the You and My fan in this equation. My co-host and You and My super fan is Sydney-based Jono Duncan, the host of the Progressive Rugby League podcast and general man about town. Jono, how the bloody hell are ya?
I'm doing good, Tom. How are you, mate? How you been?
Yeah, good. Busy. It's been a while between drinks, between episodes, so I've had a good few weeks to sink my teeth into Hourly Daily, which I've thoroughly enjoyed. That's what we'll be getting our beaks into in episode 3. We're talking Hourly Daily from 1996. Before we get stuck into the record, our regular disclaimer, myself and Jono are in no way affiliated to UMI. We're just two fans talking music for the love of the game. If you found this show, there's a good chance you're already familiar with the group known as UMI, but if not, listen to their records, go to their shows, send them all your money and love. They bloody deserve it. Jono, you give off the vibe of a nervous lawyer. Anything to add to that disclaimer?
No, nothing at all. That's absolutely perfect. I was just thinking, you're right, it has been a few weeks since we chatted. And I actually do have a related story to share, and it's one filled with regret, if I may.
Bring it on.
So during this hiatus, it was about 3 weeks since we've last spoken, I went to see a Hard-On's gig. Now, Hard-On's are led nowadays by Tim Rogers. And it was a gig in my local hood in St. Peter's in Sydney. So I thought it was kind of a last minute decision. I decided to go down late one Saturday night after the footy and just kind of check him out. I've never really seen him. Tim's been leading the band for the last year or so. And I thought, yeah, a good chance for me to check him out. And so I went down to the gig. It was like a semi-final of the rugby league on and I walked into the bar and there was still 5 minutes to go, so I was just there by myself. So I just parked myself in front of the bar with a beer in hand, just watching the last 5 minutes. And then a tall man, sort of strides up beside me and parks himself to my left, 1 meter to my left, and watches the football next to me. And so it's Tim. He's wearing his cowboy hat. He's half an hour away from the gig starting. And there I am going, okay, what am I going to do? I've got to say something. What am I going to do? He turns around and then orders from the bar. And I'm like, damn it, I should have bought him a drink. That was exactly what I should have done. So I missed that opportunity. So then he's there, turns around again, watches the footy. And I'm there thinking, okay, what am I going to say? And then Ray Arn, the bass player from the Hard-Ons, comes up and starts talking to him like, damn it, there's my chance missed. Ray's now talking to Tim. They're having a good chat. I won't bug them. And then I'm thinking, okay, I can still maybe bug them both and sort of chat to them both. And then another punter who's sort of standing in front then turns around and starts talking to Tim. And that's my chance gone. And then I just sort of like go into the band room. I'm like, just stopped it. That's what happens when you kind of, you're a bit cautious. You got to just go all in, don't you? So regrets, didn't talk to Tim, had my chance. He was standing right there. I wanted to ask him what's happened to his radio show. I wanted to say thanks for all the help during lockdowns and stuff. But anyway, what do you do next time?
My first impulse was that you should have told him about the pod. But then that is probably the least way to ingratiate yourself to someone. Yeah. Hey, mate, been a fan of your work. And me and a buddy, we're going track by track through every song on your main band. But I'm a totally normal fella. I'm a really normal guy. Let's have a beer. Let's share a brew. But no, that's on brand. Don't meet your heroes, but stand next to them and be neurotic. I think that's got a ring to it.
Yeah, I actually have met him once. Maybe I'll tell that story in another episode, but very brief, typical fan engagement. But yeah, this one, I felt like could have been much more, but likely wouldn't have been.
No, the time will come. There will be a proper meeting of minds. We'll get to that meeting, the prior meeting that you had in another ep for sure. Yeah. I think I shared my Tim meet cute story in LA last ep. But yeah, just for any new punters, the format for this show is we'll just discuss a few notes on what led up to the recording of the album. Then we'll go through the record track by track. And then, yeah, we'll just finally talk about what happened after the album dropped, give our gold, silver, bronze, and make it clear that we think every track is a jewel, zero bullets.
the 15-0 on this one.
Yeah, once again, they fucking nailed it. yeah, there's tons of, you know, stuff that you can just wiki about the record, but the thing that jumped out at me in terms of the main difference between Hourly Daily compared to the first two records is that this one was recorded in Australia at Q Studios in Sydney. And it seems like I could be wrong here, but just based on my sleuthing, it seems like this was kind of self-produced by the band. UMI is listed as the producer, but it seems like they got help from Paul Kircher, who also played some tracks on the record, and then Wayne Connolly, who was involved in the first couple records as well. But yeah, I felt like that because in terms of interviews with Rogers about the inspiration for Hourly Daily, he talked about being on tour overseas and feeling nostalgic and homesick about Australia. And so it's interesting to think about the songs or at least the themes or lyrical content was perhaps inspired by his time overseas, but he was able to kind of like him and the band bring it to fruition in Sydney. So that was really the only kind of main thing that jumped out at me in terms of potential useful insight about the recording of the album. But I'm sure, Jono, you've got some more nuggets up your sleeve.
Yeah, well, I'll just take it back a step perhaps. So I guess if you and I have a place in the Australian consciousness, it's obviously through Hi-Fi Away and Hourly Daily, and that's news to no one. If there was any doubt, you know, see the enormous sellout national tour when they played those two albums in full, I think back in 2013 or 14, I think. And if you're lucky enough to get a window to leave your mark on a culture, this is a pretty good way to do it, I reckon. You know, two ripping but very different albums released, I think, in consecutive years, that just sort of cemented the band not only as positively, absolutely rockin', but with creative chops and creative capabilities. We raved last time about Hi-Fi Away, and we spoke about how much of a departure that album was from Sound as Ever, you know, a crackling, fizzing, popping record to build on Sound as Ever's immense riffery. And then you've got Hourly Daily, which we rugby league fans like to call Laurie, which is just as big a departure from Hi-Fi Away as Hi-Fi Away was from Sound as Ever. Now, there's actually a lot to unpack with Hourly Daily, and luckily a lot of that work has already been done for us through the brilliant, should be award-winning radio documentary by Triple J, and more specifically, I think a bloke called Chris Gatton, who goes in depth with the band and others on the making of the record. And FYI, the doco was recently made available again on Double J, so I'm not sure if it's still available, but yeah, do not stop until you wrap your ears around it, because it's that good. But even with that amazing program, there's still a lot to say about Hourly Daily. It's that rich an album. I guess we should start with the album thematically, a quite ambitious undertaking, a concept album that kind of takes us through 24 hours in the life of the Australian suburbs, as you mentioned, Tom, starting from the pre-dawn paranoia of the mother of the skinhead, through brekkie radio and milk deliveries and local gossip to quasi love stories and hitting the town and heading on home in the rain. And in the Triple J doc, the band kind of played all down. Tim calls it like a garbled attempt at a song cycle, for example. But I don't know if I'm missing something, but to my ears, this is no half-baked attempt or concept that kind of fizzles. It's legit. They've nailed it. It's a brilliantly conceived, idiosyncratically delivered concept album, song cycle, whatever you want to call it. And although this is UMI's most popular album, I think it's the only one to go platinum, it, and is considered, you know, a classic. So it's popularly and critically acclaimed. I'd still question whether this album gets the kudos it deserves. I mean, you know, where are the points for ambition, the added points for ambition? Now, with most albums, you know, Tommy, they're just a bunch of songs really held together mainly by the thread of the singer's voice and also the way a certain combination of people make sound together. And I don't mean that as a negative at all. And of course, like, there are heaps of albums that have recurring themes throughout, you know, relationship breakdown is the most common, but not many albums at all in the scheme of things, when you think about it, that attempt and pull off a concept album. And in this case, it's a concept album that delves into a whole culture. You know, a concept album is usually pretty specific, I reckon. Even, you know, I'm thinking Paul Kelly's fantastic Spring and Fall, which coming at that concept from different angles, it's still about the specific experience of a relationship's blossoming and ultimate busting. Ali Daly, on the other hand, is broader. It's suburbia. It's where most Australians live, but it kind of delivers stories specific to various parts of a typical day that we can all relate to one way or another. Listening to shit breakfast radio, gossiping with your neighbours about stuff you actually have no idea about, you know, trying to nab a kiss during a crummy film, the front and back of a cab during a night out, Friday night drinks. It's a songwriting triumph and it's a creative triumph. And, you know, I really can't speak highly enough about it. And we haven't even got to the album musically, which we'll do as we go through track by track. But I will just say that this record, you kind of mentioned the recording process. For me, it's the band exhibiting peak confidence and assuredness, you know, trying things, bringing in the strings, the horns, trying different sound techniques. You can feel the sense of excitement they were feeling as they pulled it all together bit by bit with people they really liked. Like you said, Paul McKercher, Wayne Connolly, the late Jackie Olszewski, to name a few. And, you know, I'm rabbiting on a bit here, but I do want to get to the record track by track. But I guess I just wanted to emboss my feelings about this album. I want my feelings about this album embossed. I don't even know if I'd rate Ali Daly as the best of my favourite You're My album. You know, it's the kind of indecipherable nature sometimes of what gets you going musically. But whichever way, it's, it really is an incredible creative and recording achievement. So I'll leave that there and breathe.
Yeah, consider that embossed, mate. And yeah, just before we get into the tracks, I would agree with concept albums. I think they can go either in one and two directions. There are kind of the prog rock concept albums where it's very explicit and direct, where it's like, Larry got up, Larry went to work, Larry took a shit, track four, Larry went to sleep. You know, it's a very obvious story. And then it can go completely in the other direction where it's incredibly flimsy. And I think they only call it a concept album because there's horns and string on the strings on the record. And they're like, yeah, it sounds concept-y. Whereas this one, because as you've mentioned, it's, I think, trying to kind of tap into like the Australian consciousness via the suburbia, and so therefore it flits around, but yet there is enough kind of thematic inertia to push you through, and so I like the concept of kind of like you feel like a bird flying over the suburbs, like swooping in and out, and I feel like it's the right balance in terms of a concept album for me, but between that kind of flimsiness and then just the obvious direct, why isn't this a music video vibe?
Yeah. No, that's a good point.
All right, let's get into the tracks then. So we kick off track one, Ali Daly. And this I remember because of my context of UMI was always the Cream and the Croc, the greatest hits compilation from when I was a young fella, and Ali Daly was the first one where I was like, I'm gonna give it a proper go beginning to end. And so I remember just being blown away from the kind of somber beginning. Is that like a viola or a violin at the beginning? Kind of that very sad tone. And I think it's a it's an amazing way to kick off the record. In terms of the inspiration, Tim was quoted somewhere that it's he was watching a documentary about skinheads, right? Mm. And it was, so this song is told from the perspective of the mother being like, what, yeah, hence the lyrics, what kind of mess have you got yourselves into? And still seeing these kind of skinheads as her, you know, beloved young children. So I think it's kind of wonderfully sad and dreamlike, which I think kind of fits the tone of considering the concept.
Yeah, the line, there's 14-year-olds screaming, get out of my country, is always one that, that resonates. And sometimes you even hear people singing it at songs, singing it at gigs. Yeah, it is an unbelievable way to start a record, really. Like, once again, like a real statement, you know, this time asking people to reconsider what they thought You or My was after the first couple of albums. So Sound As Ever started Full Throttle with Coprolalia. Hi-Fi Way started with Ain't Gone and Open, you know, introducing the band's new rusty-infused vibe. And Ali Daily starting with, you know, the title track, an uneasy kind of trepidatious track, but, yeah, lush and beautiful all the same. And as you say, it's about the mother of a skinhead and, I guess, the nonstop worry and the feeling of helplessness or powerlessness that would come with seeing your son lurch into, I guess, you know, white supremacy or something, you know. And I feel like the subject matter of that song is even more pertinent in the 2020s than it was in the 90s. Mm. You know, it's an amazing song and really a superb start to the album. And yeah, you could consider it, you know, as you say, as I intimated earlier, as like the pre-dawn reflections of a racing mind that comes from, you know, many sleepless nights of worry. Mm. And then the alarm sounds and the thrills and the spills and the mundanity of a typical day in suburbia is all about to kick off.
Yeah, and I've the 14-year-old screaming get out of my country. I guess because I listened to this album properly after the Cronulla riots and then kind of retraced my steps. I was like, oh, it's kind of prescient in a weird way, considering that was all kind of on the horizon. And as you mentioned, still kind of part of Australian culture in some way, shape or form. And yeah, For me, thinking back on kind of the journey of the track by track experience of the album, I had this weird dream a few weeks ago where I was like in a weird fantastical art house film that felt like it was directed by Salvador Dali, and it was starring Tom Barrass, the fullback for the West Coast Eagles, my AFL team of choice. And it was bizarre and fucking nonsensical. And then, yeah, my alarm went off and then my day started. And like, but for a while I was completely in this different reality and I wasn't necessarily embodied in Tom Barrass, but I was in a completely different state of mind, and it was startling and fucking psychedelic and weird. And then it was gone in an instant when I woke up. And so I felt like that it's cool to kind of consider this where you're perhaps you're in the mind of someone, or perhaps this is just a dream of someone where someone is kind of embodying a completely different life of their neighbor or someone else in their suburb perhaps. So it's cool when you think about it from that kind of just a mind exploring different other lives in their suburb.
Yeah.
All right, track two, Good Morning. We've got the alarm clock. It's the start of the day. And we've got a track that's built for the mosh pit. This one you can give. This is the leg workout for the mosh. What are your thoughts on Good Morning, Jono?
Yeah. Well, in the radio doc, this song gets a lot of love and a lot of attention, and rightly so. There's a lot to it. I think Andy Kent comments in the doc that he considers it kind of as the quintessential You Are My song. And I get that. It's a bit loud. It's a bit sweet. It's lyrically clever how it pokes fun at commercial radio, and all the same, you know, I've got to say though, as someone who came to Ali Daily late, and remember I became a fan after the number 4 record, it took me a while to really embrace this song, but I think seeing it live a few times helped me get it, you know, because actually live as kind of Tim alludes to in the doc, it has like an extra kick and it's quite a rocking song. And so, yeah, and yeah, lyrically very clever and a great sing-along tune, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm trying to understand the lyrics on a more deeper level because I guess it's the one of the poppier upbeat numbers. And I guess as far as I can gather, my limited education and brain capacity, but it seems like he's kind of singing about the love-hate relationship that you have with the radio, perhaps, and that it's kind of it's cheesy and but yet and I don't know, repetitive, but yet you find it comforting and it's kind of a necessity and it allows you to kind of feel a connection to other people through music and people just talking shit. And am I on the right track?
Yeah, I guess so. It's that familiarity, I guess, that we all crave that helps us get us started, I guess. But yeah, it also pokes fun at kind of the lameness of it and, you know, the competitions and the usual kind of rubbish that you hear. But yeah, I guess it's just a typical kind of start to many people's day. I guess commercial radio back in the 90s was especially FM commercial radio was a huge thing, and it's probably not as big these days. I mean, it's still around and, you know, there's still influential kind of disc jockeys. You know, Kyle and Jackie O are still around, believe it or not. But, you know, it's probably less influential than it was because people sort of, you know, have podcasts and Spotify and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I think definitely back in the 90s, it was even more of a cultural thing as well.
Yeah, that's probably true, especially considering kind of the indie rock roots of UMI, where they probably had a weird perspective on like commercial radio, where they were like, well, we want to get there eventually so we can sell more records and go on bigger tours and all that. But then it's a different vibe from where they came from. So, but yeah, great fucking and track.
And the radio doc goes through this, but a famous drum fill, excuse me, from Rusty, which leads into like the rambunctious end to the song. That's a drum fill apparently that he gets asked a lot about and is taught in drum lessons. So, you know, a bit from the radio doc, which I believe is no longer available.
Well, I'm going to keep hunting for that bad boy because, so track three, Mr. Milk, with a beautiful at the start, which I think is kind of a sweet little way to kick off the number. Jono, what are your thoughts on Senor Milk?
It is a really sweet song. I guess it's purposefully a little naff, but it works perfectly. You know, some great lines in there. Tim, you know, having fun with the character. You know, 4:30 a.m. ding dong rise. And, you know, kiss a photo with a beam from the ashtray light, or morning sun makes my sour heart pasteurize.
Yeah.
You know, like some great lines. And Mr. Milk, whoever he is, seems like a big-hearted, earnest bloke. He just wants a little affection, you know. We're all a bit like that. We'll have a bit of Mr. Milk in us. So, and then, you know, some epic drumming towards the close as well. So sweet little track and pretty rocking towards the end. Another live favourite.
Yeah, this might be one of my favorite UMI riffs, just the guitar riff itself. I think I saw this little mini Vice doco about the Hives, Hate to Say I Told You So, where it was just like an 8-minute doc talking about that song. And the lead singer of that band was like, yeah, if you've got a really good riff, just play it over and over again and don't change it and people will lose their fucking shit. And I think that's a sign of a great riff where you can just kind of loop it and work a song around it. And yeah, this is one of my favorite tracks off the record. The morning sun makes my sour heart pasteurize. The way he stretches sour across two words is genius. And yeah, at the end, he references, this is something, because I'm not typically a lyrics guy, through doing this pod I've done more detailed analysis thanks to genius.com and songmeanings.net, but Kintale Road, which he references at the end, is a street in the Perth suburb of Applecross. The Rogers family lived in Applecross when Tim was in primary school. The suburb is also referenced in the Applecross Wing Commander from UMI's previous album, Hi-Fi Way. So a little bit of Perth that sneaks into Mr. Mill. Maybe that's why it's got, I like it so much. But, big fan of this track.
And on that riff you mentioned, this is part of the radio doc as well. So it's, a homage to an XTC track, I believe. And there's a few homages through this album, you know, at the end of the day. These guys are music fans, you know, you'll hear a bit of Who at the end of Flagpole 180 and other places as well, little faces here and there. And, yeah, there's a bit in the radio doc where I think it was Paul McKercher or Wayne was driving up with Tim to play a gig at Livid. And they turn on the radio, Triple J and Helen Razor, I believe, who was one of the breakfast show DJs at the time, sort of came on the radio and said that Mr. Milk was a direct ripoff from a XTC song. And they're just like, what? It's like, you know, and they kind of reference how, you know, pop music's all about, you know, homages and sort of quotation and building on what's been built before. So, there's a bit of annoyance, I guess, lingering annoyance from that. But that's kind of part of the fun of being a music fan and making music. So
yeah. Unless you get sued, you didn't steal it. That's my kind of general rule of thumb when it comes to this type of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Track 4, Soldiers. This is the one where my note here is it a concept album unless there's a brass or string section? Like, this is the one where I think, you know, you could perhaps tell if you're you and my fan who listened to the first two records that Ali Daily was going to be different from, like, the way the first three tracks have kicked off. But then with Soldiers, it's like, here's a bit of brass. Shit, we got a concept album. It's actually happening. So that I was, you know, trying to kind of transport my brain back to 1996 and imagine what I would have felt like if I was, you know, a 19, 20 year old UMI fan who'd listened to the first couple, and then I would have been like, oh shit, this is real. It's this is happening.
This is it, guys.
Yeah, yeah. Track 7's gonna be Larry Took a Shit. This is shit got real. But what are your thoughts on Soldiers?
Yeah, I mean, the sun's getting higher now in the sky. We're maybe at the local milk bar or cafe for a cuppa and a muffin. And then, you know, the local chatter and gossip and conspiracies about the goings-on in the local neighbourhood. You know, they're digging up the road and widening it just so you can suffocate at home. Cool song, and musically in the radio doc, Tim references Faces' influence for those interested. And it's great to see this song live, because A, you know, it goes hard, but also B, it includes you know, one of the few moments that people sing along to. It's not really easy to hear when people are singing along to UMI at gigs, and I guess that's because it's just loud and you know, it's not that many anthemic moments in their songs, I guess, but you know, in You Woke Me Up Just to Check That I'm Alive, we talk to each other as if we're five. I've heard that sung a few times, and to my surprise initially, but it makes sense. You know, it's a great line. It's also a quiet part of the song musically. So, great song.
Yeah, just on that part of the song, I noted down that there's some really cool little drum things happening in the background from Rusty at that point, where he's kind of like building tension. And then it kind of explodes after that, after We're Five, as if We're Five lyric. And something that one of those kind of subconscious things where you're like, oh, this is cool track. It's kind of building. But then when you really kind of closely listen to it, you can kind of see why the kind of, I guess, the technical ability of the drummer to kind of like build that tension quietly in the background. Mm. And yeah, I guess in a weird way, I grew up in the northern suburbs of Perth, so like very far away from kind of any type of like inner city, meet at the milk bar for a chat with the neighbor type of vibe. But at least there was a little bit like that growing up. And, you know, this is kind of the lament of every man over a certain age with the podcast, but it was different before phones. Just in terms of people spoke to each other, they really connected. And no, but it did make me slightly nostalgic just in terms of the stuff that I would hear the adults talking about. And just the kind of necessity to kind of congregate more in public spaces, which mm-hmm. now it's kind of like, well, Google will tell me whether it's a good time to visit the muffin shop, see how busy right. it is based on their graph, to kind of avoid people. And yeah, in this song, I guess they're referencing the banter and you know, just kind of gossiping that can occur, but then it, in a weird way, and things like Mr. Milk and, you know, other tracks on this record did make me nostalgic for that Australia, which is now mainly due to the advent of technology is eroding pretty quickly, at least in big cities.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. Like, to an extent, you know, it's kind of been replaced in a way by like, you know, cafe culture, which is a very different sort of culture to, you know, the local neighborhood milk bar or whatever, you know what I mean? So it's a bit more, you know, is there a table ready? Oh, okay, well, I'll sit outside. Can I get that table? Can I get, should we have a chat? Where's my, yeah, all that sort of stuff where it's not really about, you know, chatting with your neighbors. It's just about, you know, having a nice meal, I guess, or.
Yeah. And while you're waiting for your nice meal or your latte, you're on your Instagram trying to boost those social numbers, trying to improve the metrics, baby. All right, track 5, Tuesday. Big fan of this one. Jono, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, when I think of Ali's Ali, there are a few songs that I think really embody the concept of the album, obviously the title track, but Tuesday is one of them too. It's another cleverly written song. The character here sees and hears everything, has their ear to the ground about all the goings on within the neighborhood. You know, we all know someone like that, and sometimes we are that person. It's that kind of weird obsession. You can become addicted to investigating every sound and finding out every detail of what's going on around you. The character here at least kind of recognizes it, I guess, which I think is a great finishing line. You know, I could do a lot more with my time, but you should hear what's going on outside. And
yeah,
then we get to the cool horns to take us out. So it's a super song. And interestingly, there's an alternate version that was released with the Super Unreal reissue with a different set of lyrics. I think it was previously unreleased. It's a good version too. It's to the same tune, but the lyrics are more kind of needy and maybe doesn't quite fit the concept of the album as much as the album version. So worth checking out all the same though. But yeah, this song kind of fits in with the album, and yeah, I can see a bit of myself in that person, and I don't really like it.
Well, yeah, I think there's tons of other tracks on this record which I think are explicitly in homage to the Kinks, whereas this I think is more kind of like a Sgt. Pepper's Beatles-y type of moment. And yeah, I was thinking a lot about the kind of the character as well that this song is embodying, and I kind of thought, I was wondering, like, in terms of being a songwriter or an artist, whether you think he's talking about, you know, just a random guy in his home in a suburb, you know, very sort of, yeah, kind of spying on his neighbors, but I was thinking, like, potentially that line, I could do a lot more with my time, but you should hear what's going on outside, kind of the artist being compulsively observing others and then putting it through an artistic filter, as opposed to just living his own life without being so self-conscious. And yeah. It seems like someone who's kind of yeah, obsessed with like processing other external stimuli as opposed to just being able to like live his own life. And so I was wondering, I've never been on tour as a muso, but I've had benders on a weekend, and after that I do feel a little fragile, and it's nice to just chuck a sickie on Monday and then be paranoid about your neighbors. So if you'd been on a 3 month tour and then come home, I'd imagine that you and then it was like, where's the big boss man from the record company? He's like, where's the next record, Rogers? You potentially might be feeling a little like the character that he seems to be writing about in Tuesday.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, I guess when you're someone creative and you're kind of always observing, it becomes almost your job in a way, and you kind of maybe become a prisoner to it. Like, oh, that guy's wearing red. He was wearing red yesterday, you know, whatever. You're kind of always in the observation mode. So maybe it's a bit of that too.
Yeah. There's a Triple J, like a version performance from about 5 years or so ago, where they did it kind of acoustically, which is pretty good. And they get that guy, Stevie Hesketh, who used to play keys with Jet with a bunch of other people. And that's a cool little performance. Great track. Track six, If We Can't Get It Together. Jono, what are your thoughts?
Well, in my mind, it's probably not the case, but in my mind, the characters in If We Can't Get It Together are the same characters in Kathy's Clown. Remember, we talked about the
way. Oh, yeah, the gym junkie and the librarian. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, they're a nice enough couple. You know, they've gotten together. They think they can make it work, but the rest of us, we're just not convinced. there's so many great lines in this song. You know, she's. You know, every line's almost a cracker, you know. She's cracking, saying, I do or I will, because she don't know how to tell him. And she's going off a pill. You know, if we can't get it together today, she's looking for his heart while he stares the other way. And then, you know, the final song, we'll just settle for a mobile home. You're a good record store, the public phone, you know. What can you say? But, yes, what a great track.
Yeah, no, I love it. This was another one I remember, like the early days of getting into this record and then cranking it in the car, driving around the Joondalup area. But it got me thinking, like, slut shaming. Could they sing this song now? Oh. this came out of left field, but I was like, yeah, because I want to let the record state that I'm extremely pro slut. I think sluts make the world go round. And I think that in the context of this song, it's kind of like as you mentioned before, let's assume it is the Kathy's Clown couple. The gym junkie is kind of like being really harsh on himself. Like, maybe his ex-girlfriend cheated on him and he's like, oh, she was a slut. You know, like he's potentially, maybe he's slut shaming in it, but I don't think Rogers is promoting slut shaming. But it's interesting where that's definitely a word where you heard it a lot more in the 90s and it was thrown around a lot more. Now there's been a slight shift in the culture. And I mentioned this on one of the I don't recall which track it was off the first record, but it was this is a head nodder of a chorus. Defy you not to nod your head. You might not dance, you might not jump, you might not sing, but you're nodding your head. You're nodding, baby. You're nodding.
It's chiropractically correct.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, you know, yeah, it's a nice easy one. But yeah, you're definitely nodding. And we might as well do it next week because we've met everybody that we're ever gonna meet. We've all been there. Oftentimes when you've been thinking that, you're completely wrong. It's the type of thing you say when you're like, you're feeling mildly depressed and slightly pessimistic about your future, and you're trying to drag the person you're in a relationship with into your mental turmoil. So that's the type of thing you say when you're in that state of mind. So
Well, on that lyric you mentioned, so what's the word that goes, his daddy's a nut, his ex-girl is a
girl slut.
And he'll be yours forever if you just get together. I guess, like, in that, it's like the language of of, you know, suburbia, I guess, you know, and would they sing it now? I mean, they do. They still do play the song as that. Would they write it now? Yeah, probably. I don't know. It's an interesting question. But yeah, in the song also there's reference. It's quite a Sydney song. There's reference to 470 to Circular Quay, which whenever I'm in the city and I see the 470, which still goes to Circular Quay, this song comes in my mind. So it's a beauty.
On that bus, if there's some roadworks ahead, do you ever tap the driver on the shoulder and go, if we can't get it together, mate?
That's right. When I see roadworks, I just start singing Soldiers. So my whole day I'm singing Ellie Daly.
Beautiful. Well, track 7, moving on, another driving track, Flag Fall, $1.80. Man, this one, prior to us even having this idea to do this podcast, I found this UMI YouTube channel guy kind of compiles lots of UMI live performances and just ones from ages ago in the 90s or whatever, and there's this live version of this track, which is kind of, because for me this is always just kind of like the beginning of the middle part of the album where you put it on in the background but none of your favorite songs. But yeah, through that live version, the song really swinging 60s, baby, kind of Austin Powers vibe. But yeah, really cool lyrics. And the tidbit that I got from my digging was that when Tim was a child, he wanted to be a cabbie. So this is him kind of potentially imagining what type of cabbie he would be, or just exploring that kind of that future that didn't come to fruition. What are your thoughts on Flag Fall, Buck 80?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, in the radio doc, Tim references that when he was a kid, he wanted to be a cab driver. And yeah, in terms of the flow of the album, I guess the sun is setting now. And yeah, it's another example of Tim's creative approach to the subject matter, I reckon. You know, looking at inner city and suburban culture from different perspectives, from a milkman earlier, from gossiping locals, and now from a cab driver, you know. And they reference the cool skiffly rhythm of the song, which is a highlight of the song. And then there's the Who homage at the end with the massive drum ending. Which is awesome as well. So, yeah, super track. I've only seen it live once at that Ali Daly Hi-Fi Way kind of anniversary gig. So I'd love to see it. I might check out that YouTube track that's making me excited.
Yeah, I'll find it. I don't believe it was Recovery, but it was a Recovery-esque type of program. But they had it. It was very 60s vibe where like each of the band members were on their little standalone podium, and then the dance floor is kind of with them, and then Andy was kind of doing the Beatles mop top kind of head shake as well. So they were grooving, baby, and I was liking it. So that was track 7. Track 8, Wally Raffles, which Perth reference here. Not a day before he fell, propping up the bar at the Raffles Hotel. Raffles is like this it's like this institution. I think I've been there like once or twice, but it's mainly it's kind of like right on the river. And it's one of those places where I think it's generally kind of, now it's kind of like an upper crust type of place, but it's one of those like places where people feel a real, you go to Raffles this weekend, like they'll go every weekend and they'll be like, oh, this is my chair at Raffles. And so, in terms of the context of this song, Wally, I imagine, would have his own kind of chair or section of the bar, or like owns the dartboard at Raffles. So that's kind of the vibe that I get in this context. But anyway, it's like a cool bar/pub hotel thing on the water, on the river.
Yeah, so I think from the radio talk, it's about Tim spending time with his Uncle Wally in the Raffles Hotel. I'm unclear if he lived there for a bit or worked there for a bit. But, Rusty mentions in the doc that you know, back in the day, it was the scene of many weird teenage experiences. So, yeah, I guess as everything else, it kind of gentrifies over time. But
yeah.
There's a great moment in that Radio Dog as well. It's kind of the band talking about Tim struggling to nail the vocal because he'd thrown his voice before recording began. He was singing at, the final Box the Jesuit gig, and he was brought up on stage to sing, I think, Faces tunes or something. And then he kind of threw his voice, and then recording began the next day. And so he struggled to nail this kind of, the screaming, singing bit about no one's listening and no one's leaving. But he had one more crack on the final day of recording and just smashes it out of the park. So that's the great thing about this Radio Doc. They kind of isolate various instruments or, you know, various vocal takes, and they isolate this vocal take. And, yeah, it kind of gets the goosebumps going because, you know, they tell the story about how that, you know, he hadn't quite nailed it. And, you know, they thought they'd give it one more chance, and he just kind of just screams at the top of his lungs, and it's just a fantastic, fantastic take.
Agreed. There's a little reference to Bro Jamie, and no one's listening to the boys, Tim, Jamie, and Gab. So that Jamie makes a little appearance as well. And, yeah, my only other thought about this one is that, I don't know, if you were going to host a pogo stick jumping class and you wanted a song to kind of pogo stick to, this one would, this got some real fucking bounce to it.
Yeah, it does, eh?
It's almost like too bouncy for a mosh pit because you like, if you had, if you were performing, yeah, too much air. I was thinking it, like, if you were, it was like a big day out, but for kangaroos in the fucking crowd, and they were really, hind legs were really fucking, it was leg day for kangaroos, and there was some big reds bouncing, you'd whip out Wally Raffles, and then, give them some pogo sticks. So if there's any pogo stick instructors listening, that one's for free. Next one will cost you. Track 9, Heavy Comfort. Jono, tell me your thoughts.
Yeah, there's another great insight from the Radio Doc here. So Heavy Comfort was originally a band song, but it wasn't really working, so they got in a string quartet and basically recorded it in one take. So pretty amazing performance by Tim and the quartet. It is kind of like a subtly dramatic song, which I've grown to really like a lot more. As like Flag 4180, I've only seen it live once at those anniversary gigs. And it went really well at those gigs as well. They brought out a string quartet. Lyrically, it's excellent, of course. You know, I don't think I've ever heard or read any explicit criticism of Tim's songwriting chops. Maybe I've suppressed it. but I've heard criticisms through Tim in like interviews, etc., where he shares things he's heard or conversations he's had with record company people. And mostly it's been about him having too many words
in
a song, something like that. But the main line in this song, I reckon, proves that he can be concise as the best of them if and when he wants to. You know, the line, for 40 seconds a day, I was sure that we were feeling less... 40 seconds a day, I was sure that we were feeling the same way, is a killer line. And basically tells you all you need to know about the state of a relationship, you know, the past, the present, the future. You know exactly what's going on in that relationship. It's a fantastic line, and it's a great song.
Yeah, I agree. And it's essentially about like a hook who's getting older, right? Is that the kind of the vibe here?
I don't know. I'd never thought about it like that, to be honest. I guess I'd never delved too deeply into the whole set of lyrics. I'm just kind of dipping in and out to various things that stick out. But yeah, tell me about
some.
That.
Well, just some. There's a line about like your mouth is for sale or something. Like there's some. But it's as far as I can gather, it's something to do with a working girl who's getting older. I could be
okay.
I could be wrong, but on this. For me, that was always a puzzle growing up, like learning to play guitar and like struggling to do to figure out an open G chord. And then like one of your favorite bands would release like an orchestral tune where it's something like this, where it's just like a song and a lyric. And you're like, how the fuck have they figured this out? Like, you're trying to do the math. They're like, these guys are in their 20s and I'm 14. I'm like, I'm struggling to figure out the acoustic fucking guitar. Now I've got to figure out. But you kind of, yeah, once you kind of figure out how the sausage is made, is that, yeah, this, you know, was a band song. And then they just go, well, here are the chords. And I actually listened to some other Triple J or Double J doc, which came out really recently, I think in the last week, where they did kind of a retrospective of their whole career and cherry picked Triple J interviews from down the years. And then, Tim was talking about like working with string and brass musicians, and they're like, oh yeah, they're like real musicians, you know, like the standard rock and roller thing where they come in and you show them what they need to do and they're like normal, respectable people. And then with this track, you can't imagine it any other way now, right? It's like this is the quintessential version. You wouldn't want the mid-tempo electric version of this anymore. It's kind of the definitely the right choice. So track 10, Dead Letter Chorus. For me, this is the one where I probably my least favorite. I'm not as gonna go as far as to say it's a bullet, but in terms of the record, I'd probably say it's my least favorite track. And I feel like it's one of those tracks where I really don't like the start of the track, and so the rest of the track it's trying to win me over, and it's you can't. It's kind of like
too late.
But it's the mumbled lyrics at the start, which I feel like it's potentially purposeful, where he's like, everyone talks so fast and walks so slow, suddenly in a town they don't know. It's kind of like disorientating feeling, which he's describing with the lyrics, and potentially that's informing the delivery. But maybe just because it's a little jarring, because this record is filled with like Baroque pop and then like straight up pop rock as well. I've always found this track, like as it goes on, I enjoy it more, but the start's a rough one for me personally.
Yeah. Well, interestingly for me, this is maybe the first song I've really latched onto in the album, I reckon. And remembering I was late to this album after becoming a fan after number 4. And I think it's directly because of the line, two kids sweat as he's trying to get his lips to her neck. Sometimes I know lines just resonate. And
yeah,
I was going to say that line resonated with me, but I think in truth at that time in my life, I yearned for that line to resonate with me. I just wanted someone sweet to go to movies with, someone with a neck preferably. But I reckon it's
you don't have a neck. Get out of here. Yeah. Beryl,
how much of a movie was you? interestingly, in the radio doc, this is one of the two songs that's not really spoken about. There's no added sort of commentary about it. They just play the song. So I'm not sure if that's because there were time constraints, or they also don't rate it as highly, or because there just wasn't much to say about it. But I don't know. But yeah, that line always resonated to me, and it's quite evocative about going on a date with a girl if you're, I don't know, in year 9 or something. You have no idea how to act. You see or hear stories about your mates, you know, passion on with girls in movies. You've missed the lesson there, and you're just watching the movie, not paying attention to the movie, going, what the hell am I meant to do here? I'm sweating. The song really resonated.
Hell yeah. Apologies to any necklace listeners out there. That was hate speech against the necklace community. And just before you mentioned, in terms of Tim mainly being self-critical about his songwriting, and just from my online sleuthing, this could just be complete innuendo, but someone was saying that he didn't like his lyrics on Soldiers.
That's true. Yeah,
he mentioned that. And yeah, I just wanted to kind of reference that. But oh yeah, and he also just generally shit on the album. I'm not sure he said that, like, oh yeah, I was listening to too much Kinks records at the time, and I'm glad people like it. I don't listen to it, which I think it sound. I'd like to think he said that. It sounds kind of pithy, and maybe he was in a bad mood. But as far as I can gather, he doesn't dislike it that much nowadays. No,
Yeah, I think he's always been like, you know, as a lot of artists are, that they don't want to look back too much. They want to, you know, keep looking forward and thinking like, you know, my latest stuff's my best stuff. You know, stop talking about stuff I did 20 years ago, kind of thing. So I think it's probably a reaction to that. But I think like, as he's sort of getting older, he's maybe mellowing a bit in that regard, although still kind of pushing forward and looking forward to the next thing. So it's probably in relation to that. In terms of the recording, in various snippets that you get throughout interviews, and yeah, you mentioned the I think the J-Files doc that recently came out, get the sense that he, especially in these first four or five albums, he's never like 100% happy with the sound of the record.
Mm.
So there are bits in the radio doc that he mentions, yeah, I wish we could have done this, or, you know, I was hoping for something like this. And so, yeah, I guess it's interesting with this particular album. It was mixed. So they recorded it in Sydney in, I think, Q Studios, as you mentioned, which I think was the, well, they mentioned it was the site of where In Excess recorded a bunch of albums, including Kick. So it had that kind of, it was like really glassy and sort of spacious surround. So it had that kind of echoey vibe. But then it got mixed in LA with David Bianco, and who I think he did a Posies record they mentioned and things like that. So he kind of references that this was the recording of this album in Sydney was the last time that he didn't feel pressure in terms of his songwriting. But in the mixing, I get the sense that he's like, oh yeah, he did a really kind of you know, that's what he does, a pristine job. You know, he makes real pristine records, David Bianco. So got the sense that, like, Tim's sort of sitting there going, oh, what do you do? I guess, like, when you hand over responsibility to someone to mix a record or something, like, you know, all of a sudden, like, it can come back and you go, oh, that's not exactly what we had in mind, but I guess we've got to go with it now, right? So,
yeah,
especially back then, I guess, when you're tied to a record company and you're sort of sitting around an office and like, oh, I really liked a Posies or a Kinks record. He's like, I know a Posies guy. He did the Posies.
They'll
get it. We'll pay him $5,000 or whatever it is. So I guess like you're kind of hand tied in some ways.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, let's move on to track 11, yeah. Baby Clothes. Well, I don't want to bury the lead here. This is my gold for the record because this was the one at the time. Back in the day when first fell in love with this record, where I was like, this feels like the most juvenile and immature song on the record, and maybe I'll grow out of this and I'll like maybe some of the more deeper ones more as I get older. Let the record state, I have not grown up. Still my favorite. The guitar tone, the hand claps, glam rock, T-Rex, the same phrase repeated during the chorus again and again and again. It's sticking all my boxes. So kind of, it's as far as I can gather, the lyrical content seems to be essentially being cool with not growing up, which is on point for this song for me at least. But anyway, well, what are your thoughts on Z Baby Clothes?
Yeah, well, I mean, just on the lyrical content, I think they mentioned this in the doc that it's a reaction to like a trend at the time where people would sort of come to gigs dressed as in baby clothes, which is weird.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know. That's kind of what they referenced it in the doc. But there is so much to love about the song. It starts with a kind of sweet, rusty, drum feel. There's a cool kind of throbbing Andy Kent bass line that comes and goes, and like an awesome horn infused jam at the end. And then Rusty does an incredible kind of toying with the horns with like a kind of like stuttering, smashing kind of drum bit as well as they get into the last bit. So the last jam kind of, for me, has a bit of a Big Star feel to it at the end too.
Yeah.
It's a cool song. It's great to see live. Actually, I remember seeing a really good version on TV. I think I mentioned the Studio 22 show that that came out, I think, around Dress Me Slightly days. So it goes very, very well live too. And it's worth mentioning at this point, because there's some great horns in this, Jackie Orzowski's contribution to this album. A lot of cool horn parts, you know, Baby Clothes, Tuesday, Soldiers, just to name a few. And he's passed, I think he passed away about 10 or 15 years ago, but he was kind of a legend in the Sydney music scene, always, you know, playing around, you know, the inner city and stuff, and had a great following and contributed a lot to this album. I think he contributed later on in Dress Me Slowly as well.
Yeah, I think that kind of they're, as a band, they're flexing their ability to veer into a new direction with the whole concept album. But then, yeah, you think of the kind of varied sounds and song styles within it, the Baroque pop rock, well, I guess is similar to Hi-Fi Way, but yeah, this is like, they hadn't really done like a glam rock tune before, but so for me, this is kind of like, again, fitting in with the theme of kind of like flitting around all these different scenes, and it still sounds like a UMI track, trademark Timmy kind of lyrics, but also just kind of like a new realm. Again, yeah, thinking back to what it would have been like to be a young fan back in the day, hearing this, being like, holy fuck, these boys can do it all. Yeah, and I think I saw this video. It's kind of sad in a way, but it's like, I don't know where the video is set, but it's modern times where someone is kind of like he's like tackled his girlfriend in the background, and there's like a junkie in the foreground doing Michael Jack the Thriller dance really well. He's moonwalking, sorry, he's spinning around, and it's one of those like harrowing kind of like modern videos of like, oh, how much does like inner city modern life suck with all this stuff going on. But the guy's nailing his dance moves, and he's like clearly had a hit of something. He's doing his Thriller in his own mind, doing his moonwalk. And I was like, oh yeah, if that was me, if I become that junkie, that I would be Baby Clothes. I would be dancing to Baby Clothes while there's all this chaos around me.
That's your soundtrack to that moment, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So anyway, that hit me at the right time, and still puts a smile on my face, and gets me moving every time I hear Baby Clothes. Track 12, Someone Else's Home. What you thinking, Jono?
Yeah, this is the other song that doesn't get spoken about in the radio doc, but I reckon it's a cool little tune with what I consider to be an awesome guitar solo. I really enjoy it. And this is mentioned in the radio doc, but I think I'm thinking of the sound of this record. But when I think of the sound of this record, you know, I think of that chiming guitar sound that permeates the whole feel of the record. And I think it's the sound of Brad Shepherd of the Hoodoo Gurus 12-string Rickenbacker, I think. So it's very pronounced in Mr. Milk and some of the solos as well, like this particular tune, and also If We Can't Get It Together, it comes to mind. So yeah, nice little tune.
Yeah, this is one for me where, yeah, kind of just like a standard album track, and seems to be kind of about doing your own thing with your chick. It's like, we don't need to, I think that's also the problem with, because Tim's lyrics are so good, you have like it's a high standard, right? And then also you got to remember, it's like it's a rock and roll album. And so I find myself sometimes going through the lyrics being like, oh, this is great, I get to like dig in here. And then I come away with it and I'm like, oh yeah, it just seems to be kind of like, yeah, young love relationship, trying to figure out their path and all that. And that's all it needs to be. But then sometimes I'm kind of like snooping around going like, what have I missed here? Like, what's really going on? But then you don't want that. Like, I don't like it when songwriting is so dense and hidden meanings. And so, yeah, for me, as far as I can gather, it's kind of just like a album track and kind of sweet, sweet guitar sound, as you mentioned. And yeah, seems to be just kind of like a straight up and down young love type of tune.
I think so, yeah. And I think the way I kind of saw it is, if we're not hot, at least we're not in someone else's time. It was kind of, for me, it was kind of like a fracturing of the relationship, or the relationship of relationships at a fragile stage. And he's kind of like thankful in a way that it's not happening in public or at someone else's home. Well, that's why I read it anyway. But like you say, it's probably just like, we've got a nice little tune going. I'll just put some lyrics together, and it's probably ridiculous to read too much into this particular song.
I think that Jack Kerouac had all these like rules for life, and one of them was like never drink outside of your own home. And I was like, oh, there's like something in that. And I just, it kind of stuck with me for years. And I was like, maybe I should think about that some more. And then at a certain point, I was like, he died of alcoholism. Like, should I really be taking drinking advice from someone like that? And so anyway, it seems to be, like you've got your home and you've got everyone else's homes. And you do different stuff in different places, I guess. Yeah. Track 13, Please Don't Ask Me to Smile. This one, just when I was in grade 6 and I opened a door for a girl and she called me a wimp. Come on, baby. That's the Australian childhood, right? There, everyone's had that happen.
Oh, yeah, totally.
But yeah, and just a surprising lyric that kind of slaps you in the face. If Someone Else's Home is kind of like a standard, somewhat predictable album track, just this one kind of like more stripped down, acoustic guitar, Tim's voice, and she calls you a wimp. It's like, all right.
Yeah.
We're playing cricket here. Let's hear the rest of the tune. This is one where it made me laugh the first time I heard it. And a really lovable song.
Yeah. And not only does she call you a wimp, but she says there just isn't need to be so fucking polite. And Tim politely agrees with her and thinks she was right. You know, it's a cool little song. It's a nice little country ditty. And I remember reading once that this song gave Tim confidence to try his hand at some solo stuff. And you could therefore argue that what rhymes with Cars and Girls, Tim's debut kind of solo album that he did with the twin set, which I think came out in 98 or 99, was kind of an extension of that in a way. It has the same kind of feel to it. So, yeah, it's a beautiful little track.
Yeah, this is the anthem of Timmy letting sensitive guys know that it's cool to be a sensitive guy.
This is
the sensitive guy awakening, a movement. Take off the baby clothes and get sensitive.
Yeah, talking to all the guys, I was like, why don't you make a record like Sound As Ever again?
Yep. And exactly.
Tommy, I think I mentioned in the Hi-Fi Way episode that in high school I used to have this folder which had, you know, dividers and, you know, all information from different classes. And on the inside and inside front, inside back sleeves, I'd write lyrics of songs. I wrote the starting lyrics to Please Don't Ask Me to Smile as like a big chunk of text. I loved it so much. But of course, like, you know, classmates would be, what the fuck is that? And I'd be like, oh, nothing. But for me, like, I just love that song so much that I need to write it down.
Yep. No, it was I can picture that folder. If we could find that folder now, the stories that folder would tell.
Yeah, stories. Yeah.
All right, track 14. We're getting close to the end. Moon Shines on Trouble. Again, this is trying to figure out what this one was about. Is it about infidelity? This one? Is it about a dude who can't keep it in his pants?
Maybe. I'm not too sure. I guess for me, it's maybe a track that was written for the concept of the album. Like, we're deep into the night now and, you know, people are doing stuff and they're sort of out and about and, you know, shit's going down. But musically, I think in terms of this song, it's easy to underestimate the rockin' nature of the tune. maybe because of the organ inclusion, but it actually goes really hard, the song live. So it's an underrated rock and track. But yeah, in terms of thematically, I haven't really delved into it too much. Just for me, it's kind of fits into the album really nicely and kind of begins our kind of descent towards the end. But there's still kind of getting a bit messy and the sort of like some issues happening. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, no, yeah, definitely the last few tracks here has a kind of a sloppy nighttime vibe. Particularly kind of the pensive type of vibe in the verse here, euphoric chorus. Mm-hmm. Definitely you feel, you know, that was that Jimi Hendrix thing where you could like hear colors or whatever. This sounds like, this sounds like nighttime, or kind of like, driving at night, getting up to mischief in the city.
I love the line, and all your daydream heroes are losing their hair, teeth, and halos, which kind of, I guess resonates with everyone who sort of grows up and sort of admires rock bands and stuff. But as you get older, you kind of realize, oh, they're just kind of, dudes.
And, dudes.
They have their shortcomings like me and the rest of us. So, yeah, good line.
All right, so the final track, as per the track listing, Who Takes Who Home. Beautiful end. I guess I'm in a weird way, it reminded me a little bit of the office that we used to work in at Jono, and like having our Friday night drinks and then like being buzzed from the Six Crown lagers that we would have in the office, and then maybe like walking to the traino or the bus station with your iPod on. Yes, we are that old. It was the early iPods, and then you playing some tunes, and I don't know, you'd kind of like maybe look at the city a bit misty-eyed, or have some kind of like, it could go one way or the other. You could be like negative about your life or your situation, but I feel like this particular track, it reminded me of my more kind of like optimistic moments, being like, oh, this is where I am now, but this is where I'll be tomorrow, next week, next year. Feeling kind of watching the city move around you, but feeling kind of stationary within it, and actually get, maybe after, yeah, like after a long week or a long night, slowing down and being able to appraise yourself or what's happening around you. That's kind of the sentiment that I pick up from this particular tune.
Well, yeah, I mean, for me, this is, I think, one of my favorite all-time UMI tracks. I think it's just a perfect way to end the album, but it's just a beautiful song in and of itself. And it kind of gets the goosebumps kind of rising out of the skin. They're kind of almost escaping when I hear this tune. Yeah, so it's the end of the night after Friday drinks. You know, weird shit's happened and now it's time to go home. Tim talks in the radio doc of the song being about him kind of pining for that Friday night after works drink scene as he walks across the Anzac Bridge, but knowing that he says, you know, I've got to get home because, you know, I'm not well and all that sort of stuff. So he can't sort of be part of it, which kind of brings an added poignancy to the song as well. And, you know, I just love the song so much. And I love the harmonies in the chorus. Like, I always sing the harmony part during the Don't Let Me Down bit. I just think it's a beautiful harmony. And actually, Tom, between recording this ep and our previous ep, like I said, we had a few weeks, my girlfriend and I did a bit of a road trip around the capital and surrounds. And we were listening to this radio doc, you know, through the Bluetooth, and this song came on. And I'm going so hard on the harmony bit here, and I'm nailing it just quietly. And I say to my girlfriend, you know what I want to do when we get to our place? And she's like, nah, I'm not really in the mood. But no, nothing like that. I want to harmonize with you. She goes, no, I said I'm not in the mood. And I said, no, I literally want to sing the Don't Let Me Down bit from Who Takes Who Home in the chorus. You know, you do the lead and I'll do the harmony.
You whip out the old iPhone voice recorder. Let's do this. Let's make a record.
We never did it, but I'm keen. It must feel really nice to sing that.
I'm just not in the mood. I've got a headache. Yeah.
Like, come on. I'm in great vocal form, but yeah, we never did it, but maybe one day. But I love the song so much.
Yeah, cracker of a track and very fitting end to, Fade to Black for, what is it, like 3 minutes? And then, hey, hidden track, baby. Huge fan of hidden tracks. Always was, always will be. And there is... Now, you can't really do a hidden track on Spotify. I guess you probably could, but it doesn't really have the same effect. Like, the whole appeal, the surprise hidden track at the house party was always, especially when you sensed it coming, when you'd be like, oh, they don't know. They don't know. In 30 seconds, then it would come on and someone would go and turn it off immediately. I thought this was over. But huge fan of hidden tracks. So hidden track/track Sistine, Forget It Sister. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's like a cute and kind of funny track. You know, it's perfect hidden track stuff, I reckon.
Mm.
You know, once again, some great lines and a really cool, excellent sort of twin acoustic guitar solo. You know, do you think that it's time we forgot about the local, the real estate man, your Christmas tan, the bills and your bifocals, leave the suburban crawl, the city gentry, but forget it, sister, I ain't going to the country. What a great, fantastic. It's perfect hidden track stuff. Who Takes Who Home is the perfect way to end the album proper. It's a cool sort of hidden track, a cool little bonus. And I think it reflects the relaxed mood of the band during recording, as I mentioned earlier. You know, should we do a hidden track? Yeah, go on then. Yeah, pop it on. Yeah, pop it on after, I don't know, 3 minutes. So, yeah.
Yeah, this is the nature of the song is kind of like the equivalent of when a rap artist will have a skit. Like they'll have Eminem will have his album and then they'll have three skits within it. And, you know, it's kind of like the funny, playful part and tacked on here. And I guess thinking about the concept of the album, I like to kind of, maybe I'm going too deep into this, but I like to think whether, is this the beginning of the new day or is this another dream? Is this like, kind of like how Owly Daily track one, is that someone, you know, awake at dawn or is it just a dream that someone's existing in and then Good Morning comes on? And likewise with Forget It Sister, is this something that someone's just imagining and their life is completely different? And then they wake up and become, or is this literally the start of the next day?
Of course, I never thought about it that way. That makes a lot of sense. You know, the line, it starts literally with Good Morning, Baby, you know?
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So yeah, that would indicate the next day potentially. But anyway, fucking there it is. But ran this by Jono because he's a purist and I wanted to make sure this was cool. But so as far as I can gather, Owly Daily came out in Australia and then they were like, got to do an international version. And they changed they replaced Someone Else's Home and Moonshine's on Trouble with Opportunities and Trike, which we're going to discuss. Supposedly to increase its overseas appeal by including songs that did not explicitly refer to Sydney or Australia. Yeah. I would also probably argue that like Opportunities and Trike are more poppy in general. So probably has more broader appeal. And they also changed the cover, right? Like the album cover isn't the telephone, isn't the pole. It's just the band.
It kind of has more of a 60s vibe. I guess they, this, I guess, is what maybe Tim was referencing in that the recording of the Australian version of the album was the last time for a while that he didn't feel pressure in terms of the songwriting. So I get the sense, reading between the lines, that, you know, because the album had like a British 60s vibe, you know, the record company people were going, oh, come on, let's really nail that sort of element. And I guess because they also changed the version of Mr. Milk, to me much more kind of, it sounds a lot more British and a lot more kind of that era. And so I wonder if the record company people are going, no, we're going to kind of lean into the British stuff and the swinging 60s stuff and you know, try to really bring out that element of it. So, yeah. But, I mean, good tunes, as you say, Opportunities and Truck. Truck's a great live track. It's been a live favourite for many years. And Opportunities, yeah, I guess, well, it has a bit of a Who vibe, do you reckon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, Trike for me, I think is the drum sound is pretty immense, kind of, yeah, just built for it to be a live kind of staple. And the harmonica fits perfectly, the organ solo. Mm. Yeah, and just kind of the, I don't know, the lyrical content where you feel all gooey and like the first love where it does kind of revert you back to being like a kid again. And yeah, as far as I can gather, that's the whole sentiment there, is that like you feel like you're just on a kid on his tricycle, yeah, triking around.
That's one of the great things about Tim's lyrics, like even like the really sweet stuff, it'll just sort of like there'll be a kind of bit of a darker edge sometimes. It's like, so in this song it's ride to the hills at night.
But your parents die.
Yeah, your parents die, your neighbors die or something, when neighbors fight. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking that actually, I've always knew it was Watch Your Parents Die, but then I was like, again, overanalyzing, but thinking kind of the concept of the orgasm being the little death and being like, oh, maybe you're watching your parents screw. You're watching them fight and then they're dying in each other's arms. Yeah. So, yeah, that's Trike. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful track. And Opportunities, yeah, this was another one where I guess probably because concurrently I was massively into The Who, but I think it's mainly the drumming really on that. It's super Keith Mooney. As far as I can gather, is he kind of making fun of a yuppie on it? It's about a dude who's kind of like always like looking for the next opportunity, kind of like trying to get ahead and throwing other people under the bus in the process. Is that the concept?
I think also like more broadly, it's kind of like, you know, at that stage of, you know, everyone's life, you know, you're in your 20s and, you know, from a band perspective, you know, there are always people, probably lots of record company people kind of going, you know, you've got to take your opportunity. This is a good chance. And similar, like even if you're not in a band, if you're just in like white collar jobs like we were, you know, stuff might come up and, you know, you got your parents or your older people going, no, this might be a good opportunity for you, you know, you know, if you don't. And so like there's kind of, that's how I didn't really delve too deeply into the lyrics of the song. So that my sentiment from just listening to it was that's what I got out of it anyway.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we did it. So before we get into the bronze, silver, gold, we touched a little bit on, the kind of mucking around with the international version, I guess probably to sell more records, try and get more fans overseas. It was another number one record, the band's second Australian number one after Hi-Fi Way. Yeah, and I think like, as you mentioned at the top, this is kind of the 1-2 punch. This is the purple patch, if you will, of the band's history, where I don't know, it seemed like a confluence of them being like, I was thinking more like, it's bands, if your first album is big, it must be extra frustrating because you're kind of like still learning how to be a band and kind of like, I don't know, maybe a little immature, but it's kind of perfect when you're like second, third, fourth albums are big because I don't know, it's kind of like, I feel like as kind of like a package, mainly Hi-Fi Way and Owly Daily, they do complement each other beautifully and, you know, shows the kind of, and I think time has been very kind on the album. It still is great to listen to. It doesn't sound aged, doesn't sound too 90s, and the songs still hold up live as far as I can gather. So yeah, they're my kind of very broad takeaways. Do you have any kind of thoughts in terms of any commentary on post release hourly daily stuff?
Yeah, I mean, just that, I guess, like I said at the top, you know, it depends the way you look at it. You could look at it as if, because people still reference Ali Daly and Hi-Fi Way as being, when you say to people that you like UMI, they'll reference those records, right? Which is probably really frustrating to the band because they've made so many good records since. And but another way of looking at it, like I was kind of framed at the top, is like if you have, you know, a little window to make your mark, this is a bloody good way of doing it with these two albums, I reckon, because, you know, popularity of bands, you know, there's a bit of luck involved, it's a bit of right time, right place, and obviously, you know, they're a great band. So I think it's overall, it's a net positive that these two albums are loved the way they're loved. Sure, it would be frustrating that it kind of overshadows everything else, but you had your little window and you made your mark with two incredible records, classic records, and this one is the second of those. Just absolutely brilliant.
All right, it's the time. The bronze, silver, and gold. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm going to. It's a tough one, of course. There's so many great candidates. But I'm going to go number three, Ali Daly, title track. I think it's, even though it's a title track and everyone kind of knows the song, I think it's like slightly underrated. I think it's such a good tune. Number two, I'm going to go, We Can't Get It Together. Just like I said, every line's a cracker. And then gold, number one, Who Takes Who Home?
It's the
tearjerker and great harmony. Did I mention that?
You sure did, mate. All right. Okay. So, yeah, my bronze is Flag Fall, $1.80. My silver is Mr. Milk. And my gold, as I mentioned, is Baby Clothes. I think, opportunities. I really like opportunities as well. That would be like the just missed the podium. But it's almost unfair doing it with this album, and it really is because there's like a million. Well, they're all pretty much great tracks. But I've come to think of this, the songs on this album as part of the Ali Daly experience. So it feels weird hearing them. Or just singling them out of context, which I guess it's maybe the issue with live music sometimes. You're like, oh, this doesn't really work in terms of combining songs from different records. But with these songs, they're all great songs, but I definitely think of them as connected through the kind of the concept of the record as well. So anyway, but there's got to be winners. There's got to be losers. But they're all jewels, baby.
All jewels. Yeah, no, I think as we bring this one to a close, it'll be interesting as we go through the next few albums, because I said, sort of Tim references that this period of time, you know, from kind of end of the Ali Daly recording process through the next few albums is when he kind of felt a fair bit of outside pressure on his songwriting, I guess, and of like the, you know, the way the band was heading. So it'll be interesting. You know, they're excellent records in and of themselves, and I'm looking forward to going through them, but also looking at them from, you know, with that knowledge now in mind, knowing that he was feeling the heat a bit. So it's great to have been through the first few albums now, and now we go into kind of a new phase in a way. So, yeah, times.
Nice one. We did it. We're still figuring out what the email address we want to use for this pod, but by the time this is out, the email address You can send your thoughts, feedback, suggestions too. Will be in the podcast app description or on the YouTube description. So yeah, if you want to share some notes, some feedback, please get in touch via that email address. And stay tuned. Next one is number 4 record. Jono, thanks for your time, buddy. This is a blast.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, everyone. Had a blast, mate. See you soon.
Catch ya.